Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Daniel, we're your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is the excellent Sam Bassini of The Athletic and of the Game Theory podcast, and as you'd expect, he and I primarily discussed the 2024 NBA draft class. It has been an eventful few months for those players, and remember, it started as a very uncertain board, so fun conversation there. And then, of course, we get into a little bit about the trade deadline. Sam and I have talked about that so much over the years, and including on Game Theory itself. This episode is brought to you by FanDuel. FanDuel.com/Boston. New customers get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed when you place a $5 bet. That is very, very cool. And I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for coming on.
Of course, Danny. I'm glad to be here. It is it's a beautiful sunny day here in Australia. It's not that hot, which is the key. We're in the middle of summer. And I might actually go for a walk after this. I might, you know, maybe we'll watch the Chiefs Bills game, but like, I'm going to probably take a little walk after this. It'll be great.
I am jealous. I live in a place that generally has good weather. It's a rainy week for us, but that's okay. The thing where I want to start, and we can kind of start with a big picture view. I find this really interesting is that like the last time you did a big board, the last time we talked about it in terms of the draft, it seemed very uncertain. I haven't been following things super closely. As you know, I don't get into film work until a little bit later in the calendar year. Is it still really uncertain? It kind of feels that way.
I think yes. I think it is still quite uncertain. I could not tell you who the number one overall pick is going to be. I could tell you like there are favorites who it could be, but I think that the group is still five or six names, something like that. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of names that really could jump up into that mix. I think Alex Sarr is certainly one of them. I think Zach Rizzache is certainly one of them. I think Nikola Topic is one of them. He is transferred to Red Star and, you know, has been out for a little minute here. And Alex Sarr has been out for a little minute here as well. There are other college names. Like I think Cody Williams could really strongly get into that number one overall mix. I think that, you know, somebody like Matas Bezelis, like if the right team just loves his offensive skill set, could go number one. I think I'd be surprised by like Jacoby Walter and Ron Holland and Isaiah Collier and those guys at this point. But I say all this to say that I think that the team that ends up at the top is going to really do like a wide amount of research and bring in a lot of different guys and try and figure out who they think is the best. There isn't like a clear number one. There are a lot of guys that I think are, you know, potential interesting top 10 picks, but probably not a guy in this class yet that has like truly emerged is what I would consider like a no doubter top five prospect. And frankly, I think that I would not have in last year's class compared to this one. I definitely would not have had anybody in this class in the top five of last year's class. And honestly, could be more like six, seven or so.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's huge. And you think about the ripple effects of that in terms of trading picks, in terms of trading picks at this deadline, in terms of trading picks at draft time. And there is an element of it that could be a little bit freeing for these personnel decision makers in the idea that if you don't think that anyone is necessarily that world beater, then you can go in a different direction. You don't necessarily, and that's not to say like, oh, go with need or anything like that. But the idea that you're not looking for a franchise savior, but somebody who can fit within is potentially, you know, it's dispiriting, but it's also useful for a team like the bottom this year, where yes, there are a lot of teams that could use that franchise savior with how bad the bottom is. But the Spurs and the Pistons and the Wizards and the Hornets are all going to need multiple good players to get out of where they are. And so, maybe you're not getting your number one this year, but if you can get a number two or number three who has a skill set that makes sense with your vision of a team, even if you don't know who your number one's going to be, like that could be useful.
I think that's right. And like you brought up the bad teams, right? Like Memphis is a bad team this year, but they are by far the one that would be like most interesting to me because they would have a serious, significant number of potential things that they could do in terms of potentially trading the pick or just like keeping it and drafting somebody that they find interesting, right? The other interesting piece of it for Memphis particularly, and I'm focusing on Memphis here, because I think they're the team that has like the most options, you know, in regard to what you just brought up. I think that because this isn't like a wing heavy draft, which is theoretically probably where I would want to look if I was them, in terms of trying to round out my final core piece. There's one guy, like I really like Zach Rizzuche. Like I think he'd be fantastic for them, as like a floor spacing, you know, defensively conscious, 6'9" bigger wing that really, really, really would work for them. But once you get beyond him and like maybe Cody Williams as well, there aren't a ton of like really, really great wings in this class. You know, Ron Holland is a guy that is quite flawed. Steph Castle is a guy that's quite flawed at this point and are certainly worthy, you know, top 15, top 20 picks in a normal draft. But like there are real questions about both of those guys that, you know, if you're drafting a last guy, theoretically you're drafting for fit around stars, especially in Memphis's case with Ja Morant, Jaren Jackson, Desmond Bain. Trying to figure out what somebody like them would do is really interesting. Trying to figure out what somebody like Houston would do if they were to get lucky and like drill this Brooklyn pick with the Brooklyn, you know, Nets just going on. I think they're what, like 4-15 now in their last 19. So the teams at the bottom, like you're just like, yeah, like, okay, we'll just take the best player. We just need to find talent. It's the teams like kind of in that middle group where if they were to really jump up and, you know, cause havoc on lottery night, those are the teams where I'm like, oh, wow, like this could go a number of different ways at the top where these teams would really be drafting for fit around stars. And like we could get like kind of a weird number one situation.
That's a great point. And something else that to consider is that if this ends up being more of a flat class, meaning like the picks aren't super valuable and the players aren't super differentiated, then that could make it easier for a Memphis to move to get the guy that they want, assuming that the team who picks number one or number two doesn't want that specific player. And can get into a little bit of the weeds here. Like this is a group that, you know, I try to follow things pretty loosely before I start to watch film, but where there have been a couple players who like have hit my radar at different moments in time that have been kind of delightful. And one of them is Zachary Richaché, which was like, you know, I love long limb French dudes. Like that's just something that's been a weakness for me for a decade now. Usually they're bigs, not wings, but Richaché, like from what I understand, it's like he's kind of a complimentary cog, like not an elite athlete, can do a little bit of a lot of things, like a capable defensive player, a capable ball handler, and he's been shooting it relatively well in the French league from what I understand. So first of all, is that understanding correct? And second of all, like, yeah, you'd love for him to be an elite athlete, but that general skill set for a guy who has credible size is really compelling for a lot of teams in a draft without a ton of like high ceiling, high floor guys.
Yeah, 100%. And honestly, like I've been really strongly looking at Rizzuche like as my potential number one guy here for a minute, because like you said, 6'9", he's shooting like a billion percent from three this season in Euro Cup competition in French league. I think the number is actually like 48% on like maybe 4 or 5 attempts per game, something like that. He was always a guy that had touch, but like never had great mechanics. He was at Hoop Summit last year and didn't seem to get like great shot prep or bend in the shot. And then additionally, like kind of had like a flat release and the trajectory would be flat, but it's clear that he always had touch. And it's clear that like he, like the ball came out of his hand softly, even though the mechanics were bad and the trajectory was very flat. And like, it looked really ugly at the time. You could see the way that it came out of his hand was quite soft. And like, you could see how that could at one day create a real shooter. It has created a real shooter in a real substantial, tangible way now, because he's done just like great work, particularly on his shot prep, in my opinion. You look at how he gets into his shot now, his feet are always set, he's ready, he can do some stuff off of movement now. He's just a really, really impressive shooter, to where you're 6'9", you're a really, really good help defender in his case. Like he is an impactful help defender across the back line, particularly. Just does a great job keeping his hands up, very anticipatory, does a great job of making sure that, you know, his limbs are in passing lanes, making sure that he's keeping big on that end, and also making early rotations. On the ball, they'll use him on like guards in the French league. He gets beat sometimes, but being 19 years old and being able to like be switchable in some respect in that regard is intriguing. The problem is there's just no suddenness to him athletically. Mm-hmm. Like he is not a great, you know, it's not that he's a bad athlete. Like he has good body control and things. Like there are different parts of athleticism. He's just not explosive. And when it translates to his on-ball game, there's just not a lot of juice there. Like, he can actually like kind of handle the ball a little bit and be able to do some things. He just struggles to separate from his man. Can that improve? I mean, look, we had these conversations about Brandon Miller. I think Brandon was way ahead of where Rizzichet is in regard to his, you know, dexterity and ball screens, understanding like how to come off of a ball screen, how to keep a guy like locked on his hip. Miller was just way ahead in terms of like his handle and like his ability to operate half court, you know, ball handling reps. I have been like asking the question of a few scouts though, like, hey, look, I think Brandon Miller is a better prospect. I want to be clear about that. Mm-hmm. But like, explain to me why you think Brandon Miller is a drastically better prospect than Zach Rizzichet. And they'll explain it is really just the self-creation that is the reason why. But then you think about like Brandon Miller was, you know, close to 18 months older than Rizzichet coming into the NBA. And, you know, I say all this to say that I think that Rizzichet is a really, really interesting prospect that I will be fascinated to see how it continues to grow over the course of the next little while, and how he looks in workouts and how he looks in his first NBA year, getting him into NBA spacing. Cause I think that could actually really open some things up. A popular name for him has been Franz Wagner for people. I don't think he is nearly as polished in ball screen situations as Franz was, or as a like passer in a lot of respects. Again, I think Franz, you know, you go back and you watch some of the Franz tape and it's definitely more polished in regard to some of the creation. But if you told me you're getting like a lesser Brandon Miller, Franz Wagner in a class that doesn't have like a lot of exciting players, that's like a pretty good player to bet on, I think, at the end of the day.
He's the player so far, from what I've heard, that I'm most excited to watch film on, just because I'll get a better read on this. And the comparisons, I mean, the idea that he could be like a help side defender is really intriguing, because you think about the players who had some intrigue in different parts of it, but didn't have the ability to defend their position. And that, I think, is what pushes Rizzichet, at least conceptually, I haven't watched him yet, into that conversation. Another guy that just delighted me to see that, A, I didn't know Jalen Williams, the Santa Clara Jalen Williams, had a brother, much less that he had a brother who was going to be a prospect of some note. I don't know, you know, obviously yet where he's going to be. It's not always fair to compare a brother. You know, these aren't identical twins. It's not the Thompson twins or anything like that. Is it fair to use Jalen Williams as any sort of a reference point for Cody, or are they just too different to do that with?
Different body types, but you can see the like similarities in terms of movement skill. So like Jalen is tremendous in regard to like deceleration, and in regard to like using his frame and his body and his physicality, and then using the ability to decelerate to like bounce off of guys and like be elite level as a finisher, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of like similar like decel traits with Cody Williams, I think, but he doesn't quite have that like strength of frame at this point. Cody has always been like a longer, leaner athlete, whereas like Jalen had like a late growth spurt. Like he was like, you know, 6'1", 6'2", when he committed to Santa Clara, got to campus at 6'3", and then like was 6'6" by the time he was a sophomore, right? Yeah. Or whatever he is now, like 6'5", 6'6", whatever. And has always had like the crazy outlier length. I don't think Cody has like the outlier length. I think he's like somewhat long. So the way that they play, the way they move is similar, but like they're different. Like I do think Jalen is the way that Jalen has played in the NBA, like it's hard to imagine somebody being as good as Jalen Williams is and like has been. Like he would be very clearly the guy that would be number three in that, you know, 2022 NBA draft class.
I may be moving him higher than three.
Yeah, and like I think that there's a case for him higher than two. No, I would have Chet very clearly at one.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot Chet's that class. Yeah, okay.
I'd very clearly have Chet at one, but like Paulo and him is like a very real conversation, I think, and people don't bring it up. I think Paulo has a little bit more upside just in terms of like being an absolute fucking bully on the NBA court physically. And like Jalen is also a bully on the NBA court in his own way. I think I would still rather have just like the Paulo size, ability to handle the ball, but if someone wanted to make a case for Jalen Williams over Paulo, I would hear it out. I don't think Cody is this necessarily, but Cody is very young and he's getting better every time I see him is the other thing. Like these dudes, like the thing about Jalen Williams is like Jalen Williams is a dog. Like that dude is a competitor. And like, people see him off the court and they're like, oh yeah, like that guy's like super nice. He seems super chill. He does these like random like unopenings on YouTube and like seems like a totally normal person. And you know, from having talked to people around Jalen Williams, absolutely true. Unbelievable dude, like great guy. But you put him like in a competitive environment between those lines, he wants to rip your heart out in every single way. And I don't think we've seen that yet from Cody. I hope that Cody develops that. I don't think he's like a bad competitor at all. It's just that I think Jalen is damn near like outlier competitor. And I don't think people have recognized it yet. They should. He is a dude, is a competitor. So comparing the two is interesting. Cody's probably kind of like his own guy though, at the end of the day.
That's totally fair. And like the other challenge with another Williams is the idea that Jalen Williams has gone so far relative to like his kind of tools. And you don't like it, it's sort of the opposite of like I've used J.R. Smith for this for years, where if like you got another roll of the dice with J.R. Smith's physical tools, you'd be like, oh, that player could maybe even be better than J.R. Smith was. Whereas like with Jalen Williams, he does a really good job of maximizing what he does well and minimizing some of the things that he's not as great at. And so that's a little bit harder. And so then asking Cody, who is a different human being, to be all of those things or even different things is a lot to ask. And so that's a real question.
Think of the pathways they came up through too. Like again, like Jalen had to go to Santa Clara because like there were very few offers there. D1, right. He was small. He had to like scratch and claw and fight for everything. Cody's been like a high level prospect. He's always been the one that people thought would be the star in the NBA. So it's a different beast. And I'm not saying that like to compare them one way or another. It's just that Cody's race is going to be very different than the race that Jalen had to run to become who he is.
That's fascinating. Next guy I want to discuss is the player that you had number one the last time you did a big board, and that's Isaiah Collier of USC, and it has been a challenging year. What?
Bad takes.
It has been a challenging year for both prominent LA schools, but USC is the topic of the discussion right now. Collier was always like, from what I recall, was always like a best case scenario could be really interesting. And is it right that what's happened is that the best case scenario just looks a lot less likely?
It's hard to separate what has made Collier struggle with USC's struggles in some respect. USC does not have a great level of shooting. Like really, like Boogie Ellis at times is like the only guy out there with Isaiah that people think can shoot. And Isaiah is obviously hurt now. Like he has the hand injury. Bronny played like a couple of games with Isaiah, and teams like are willing to guard Bronny out there a little bit. But like Kobe Johnson, like the way that you play him is you try and cut off the drive. And if you get a late contest, great. Their bigs can't really do much at all. It's quite frustrating and annoying. The bigs have also, in my opinion, hindered Collier from a distribution and passing level. Like he will make like high level reactive passes, and the big's hands just like kind of aren't good enough a lot of the time. Like they'll just like drop passes and they'll like bobble them and things like that, or they'll miss shots around the rim that he kind of feeds them. So there's a lot there that I think makes Collier look a little bit worse than what he has been. Also, the turnover issue and like the wildness and like predetermining reads a lot of the time. And then like on reps where he doesn't predetermine, like, and he just like kind of gets lost, like he'll jump and not have a plan. Like jump passing's all good. Like we're all here for jump passing Tyrese Halliburton, but jump passing is good when you got a plan. Like Tyrese jumps and goes up with a plan and a counter. Isaiah Collier, it seems like, does not have that at this point. So he needs to showcase a little bit more control, I think. And then additionally, the shooting, I mean, like, I don't know what to make of the shooting yet. And teams don't. And he had a good start to the season. The shooting, I think the shot looks better itself. Looks a little bit cleaner than what we saw last time. But, you know, he needs to prove to teams that, like, he's going to be able to force somebody to go over the top of a screen and not just go under. Because if teams can go under his screens, it's going to be hard for him to make the plays that he wants. But, you know, 6'4", elite downhill athlete, like, super superb downhill athlete, creates force in such a real way, physical, strong, has a great first step, great intersection of that speed and power. You know, he'll go somewhere, I would guess, in the top 20. It's like seriously, like Jalen Hood-Schifino went in the top 20 last year, and like way better prospect than Jalen Hood-Schifino, like way more interesting across the board. So he'll go somewhere, I think, in the top 20. It's just like, I think that the where exactly is going to be really interesting to track.
Makes sense. And I mean, you think about what can happen between now and then, and Eye of the Beholder stuff, and like Collier, from what I understand about him, like he could be somebody who the ecosystem isn't good right now. And so then getting him in something different could be there. But generally, it takes a certain type of like mentality to get ready to ramp up to that level and then to actually make the most of it. And not everybody does. And that could also lead to him being a better pro than collegiate, which is very possible. That happens all the time, too. I'll open the floor to you in terms of like kind of other players that are towards the top of the bill right now.
Yeah.
Who you think for somebody who focuses more on pro basketball would be a name worth like keeping an ear out for, keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, the most interesting prospect in this draft is like by far Reed Shepard.
Interesting. I don't think I know much about him at all. I know you had him high on your last board.
So Reed Shepard right now, he is a guard at Kentucky. He is listed at 6'3". I do not think he's 6'3". He is like a white kid that does not have a ton of length and doesn't have like a crazy amount of explosiveness. But Reed Shepard currently is averaging in 26 minutes a night, 11.8 points per game, 4.1 rebounds, 4.2 assists, 2.5 steals, nearly a block per game, shooting 57% from the field, 55% from three, and 83% from the line.
What the hell?
And he is like, he's a freshman. He is the most reactive, like intelligent, high IQ player in the country. I don't think there is I'm like not convinced that like if you put Reed Shepard in a bigger role that there'd be a better player in college basketball. He is outstanding when you watch him. Sometimes like he'll take over and play point, and they'll move Rob Dillingham, who also is a really interesting prospect in and of himself, potential lottery pick. They'll move him off the ball. Sometimes they'll play Reed off the ball, and he can make high level connective reads. Unbelievable passer, outlet passer, unbelievable, transition player because of his ability to pull up from three, his ability to space to the corners and three, his ability to make reads when he's on the ball and find teammates at a really high level. Defensively, outstanding. Like, has great feet, has, I think, the best hand-eye coordination of any player in this draft, and some of the best hand-eye coordination I have seen point blank. He is so disruptive and tough. It's just that he's probably more like 6'1" to 6'2", like a white kid that doesn't like separate all that well, and he doesn't look the part. Like, let's just say what it is. There are not many dudes running around the NBA that look like Reed Shepard in terms of being this small, not having this much explosiveness, like everything. But he is so smart and understands the game at such a high level and is so skilled that teams like every organization I've talked to has a guy that is like the Reed Shepard guy in their front office who's like, this is the dude in this like he's the man in this class. Maybe not the number one pick, but like he's like a top five guy for sure. And like I would be the Reed Shepard guy in the front office, basically. But you know, then there are other people in front offices that are just like, no, there's nobody that looks like this. Like, how are you gonna sell me on this working in the NBA and this being worth a lottery pick? There are people that like don't think he's a lottery pick. He is a truly fascinating player in a way that I can't remember there being somebody this interesting near the top of a draft.
That combination of everything is really, really fascinating. And so like, I'm thinking about his defensive role because you talked about the steal rate. Do you think he's more of like a point of attack defender? Is he more like, so the interesting kind of disparity here that I'll draw.
He's good at both.
Caruso versus Gary Payton. So Gary Payton, they're both really good defenders. Gary Payton is much better on ball than off ball. I mean, he has good on ball instincts. Yeah. Caruso, it depends. Like Jared Dubin did a great video on him recently about how good he can be on ball, but he can also do some really good help stuff. Like if Shepard can do both of those things, then him not necessarily being an on ball ball player offensively, like he can make that work. Like you, it can get a little bit tricky, but you can. And when you're, you know, if the off ball game works as well as it might, I mean, like I'm looking at, so he's only taken 71 threes so far, but he's making 55% of them at 83% of his free throws.
He can shoot. Like there's no, he's definitely an elite shooter. Like there's no concerns there.
That's fascinating. I mean, and to have that like description that you just gave in a like the opposite of top heavy class is really, really weird, because then what happens is, you said, like there's a Reed Shepard guy in every front office, is does one of them listen high? Like, because basically one of the things that I'm noticing about this class, and you talked about this when you wrote your board in December, is a lot of these players don't really have great floors. And if Reed Shepard has the floor of like, he's definitely going to be in rotation, he could potentially be like a, you know, maybe not a high level starter, but like a valued low level starter in the league, like that's not bad. Like so
here'd be my counter to this again, like as somebody that, again, like I love Reed Shepard, I have him as a top five player in the class, so I'm saying that here from the jump. Is his on-ball defense going to be as effective at 6'1" to 6'2" in the NBA as it is in college, when he's, you know, 185-190 pounds? Like the smaller guys that tend to work in the NBA, the super strong ones,
right?
Fred VanVleet, Chris Paul, like guys like that, guys that are like switchable and can really just like body up and do shit like that.
Well, and Gary Payton, I brought him up, like he's strong too.
Yeah, but like Gary's big though. Like Gary's like 6'4" or so. Like that's the difference. That's like same with Caruso. Like Caruso's 6'5". Like there are a lot of guys that are in that like 6'4" to 6'5" range. Like Bruce Brown is probably what, 6'4", let's call it.
He's 6'4", I believe.
Yeah, where you can swing it, kind of like you can make it work because they're just big enough and just long enough. Reed is 6'1" to 6'2" probably, with, you know, 6'3"-ish wingspan, let's say. Do teams just try and switch guys onto him all the time? Like if you're the Clippers, do you think Kawhi Leonard has recourse, or like do you think he has recourse against Kawhi Leonard, like with his hand-eye coordination to be able to do anything against him, when Kawhi just puts his fucking shoulder into him and goes, yeah, good luck, guy. Good luck, buddy. So it's, there are going to be guys that I think Reed can be successful against, but then there are going to be matchups where I think he's going to really struggle like on defense. So there's just, so even when you dive into the intricacies of Reed Shepard, it's fascinating. Like trying to figure out where everything sits is so hard to determine. I just bet on like elite feel, elite skill, and just say, all right, if I'm going down with the ship in this class, I'm going down with the guy that I know how to play, knows how to play basketball and is elite as a shooter and works his ass off defensively and fights. And yeah, give me Reed, I guess. But like it's fascinating to talk to different people about him.
It's true. And even you can think about like the limitations with somebody like Dante Exum, and like, and Exum was a legit athlete. He's also bigger too. Like Exum, I think, is like
Dante is 6'5". Yeah. Dante is big.
And so, and long. So like, yeah, it is. It is an archetype, like a player development arc that we just haven't seen, and could work. That's really, really, really fascinating.
I've been trying to ask for a long time. Like I ask everybody that I talk to, who do you think is the guy that reminds you most of Reed Shepard? I've gotten everything from like the bigger guys, like, you know, Derek White is a name that came up. Someone brought up George Hill to me. I thought that was kind of interesting, but George was so long, despite being like 6'2" or whatever. Someone brought up Kirk Heinrich to me. I think that was Corey Talaba. He's in the public space. I'll shout out Corey. That was an interesting one, I thought. And then like other people will bring up, like someone brought up Austin Reeves to me. But he's a better shooter than Austin, is smaller than Austin. And then like someone brought up like the, why is he not smaller like Tyrese Haliburton in terms of the passing and playmaking and shooting? Like why is he not you know, Jalen Brunson type? And I'm just like, I don't think he is, but I'm not going to sit here and fight you on it, because I think that the guys that have tended to break out in the recent NBA above, like, you know, what their physical tools might, maybe not even like physical tools, but the guys that have tended to break out in the NBA recently, in my opinion, are more the like feel skill intersection guys, as opposed to the like, you know, elite level tools guys. Shea has like a combo of both, right? But Haliburton, You know, Derek White, I would argue, is like more feel and skill. Jalen Brunson, guys like that, like these guys that are not necessarily wildly explosive. Some of them have great physical tools, but not always. Tyrese Maxey has great speed, but I would argue that like his thing is more just like intersection of shooting and like improving as a feel guy. So to me, like, these guys that are elite in regard to the skill feel combination, I don't like to put ceilings on them because we've kind of seen that ceiling broken time and again in this era of the NBA in like a real way.
It's a really important point. And like, I mean, the idea of Halliburton, and I mean, I'll have to watch Shepard's video myself, but like you can, if you're a really good passer and have good instincts, there are a lot of different things you can do. And Halliburton is bigger, and that size does help him as a passer, but it doesn't help him as a defender necessarily. Like he's still very limited in that respect. And like Halliburton's not in the traditional athletic senses. Like he's, you know, he's thin. He's not necessarily the most agile dude in the world, though he's not bad. Like he's just, it is really interesting. And like what that, I love players who challenge our notions of like what profiles and what doesn't, because like sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Like we're going to see this with Amen Thompson at some point, you know, like the idea of like he challenges the notions in a different way, and like whether that's going to work or not going to work. Lots more to discuss, but first a message from FanDuel. The NFL regular season is wrapped up, but there is still time to get in on NFL action with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, new customers can get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed when you place a $5 bet. That's $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. The app is so easy to use, and there's so many different ways to bet, like live same game parlays. Find bets in the new Explore tab. You can make a parlay in the Parlay Hub, the best way to find popular parlays and more. So visit FanDuel.com/Boston and make your first bet a layup. FanDuel, official partner of the NFL. Must be 21 or over and present in select states. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino LLC. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as a non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit fanduel.com/RG. In Colorado, Iowa, Kentucky, Michigan, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Tennessee, and Virginia. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 in Arizona, 1-888-789-777, or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-9-WITHIT in Indiana, 1-800-522-4700, or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas, 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana. Visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 1-800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts, or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York. Another player I wanted to discuss, at least briefly, it is super weird to have like the, what I, at least from what I understand, to be the best player in college basketball, just be in kind of a different conversation. That's Zach Edey. Like Edey having another dominant year for Purdue. But basically my question is there really, we know he's such a known commodity at this point for both college circles and NBA circles. What is he doing? What could he be doing to fundamentally change his place in the NBA conversation?
Yeah, I don't really think he has, to be honest. I know that, you know, like, so like John Cavoni, like moved up Zach to the lottery, right? And I think that got like a big push from people that were like, oh, this is amazing. This is super cool. Like this outlier guy that is 7'4", you know, he's a potential lottery pick. I'll be honest, like I haven't talked to a team yet that sees Zach in that range. There are teams that see him as a potential first rounder for sure. And frankly, like I have Zach Edey right now as like a late first round pick. And I think that if Zach Edey would have stayed in last year's draft, which was by and large a stronger draft than this one, I think he would have been picked in the 30s. I think he just decided to go back to Purdue. Purdue, seemingly at least, put together a great NIL package. And, you know, Edey is the best player in college basketball. And I think that, you know, maybe he didn't have a great taste in his mouth after they lost to a 16 seed in the NCAA tournament, literally punched a hole in a whiteboard, if I remember correctly. Like, I think there are plenty of reasons why Zach probably wanted to go back. Also, I think that what you're saying by and large is right, that the conversation around him hasn't changed all that much. He's essentially having the same year he had last year. It's just that this is a slightly worse draft than last year. Well, significantly worse at the top, but like, even as you go down through depth wise, like, I think it's a worse draft. And I think that has slid Zach up the, you know, up the range a little bit. So yeah, like, I'll end up with Zach somewhere 20 to 30, but yeah, like, I haven't talked to a team that sees him as much more than like a, you know, 20 to 30 guy.
It's also just, I mean, we talked about how, like, how Reed Shepard is pushing against stuff. Like, super tall guys who don't really move very well are, it, you know, they have a tough track record in the modern NBA, and it'd be great to see somebody defy that. And inevitably we do in certain forms, and we will continue to, but like, you're betting on an outlier in that way too. Like, it doesn't have to just be the short dude who isn't necessarily a great athlete. It can be the tall guy who has specific limitations too.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Like, Zach's are, can he move in ball screens? I think Zach has done a great job over the last couple of years of becoming a really good positional drop coverage defender in college. Also, the court is a little bit smaller in college in drop situations, and I worry about guards who are quicker in the NBA being able to turn the corner on him in NBA spacing in a way that they aren't necessarily capable of at Purdue. I that's what it's all going to come down to for Zach. Like, I think Zach is going to be able to establish position against almost any big in the NBA. He's that strong. Like, yeah, it won't be the easiest thing in the world when he's battling against Steven Adams, right? But also, he is 4 inches taller than Steven Adams, which is wild to think about. And he has a wingspan that I think is 8 inches longer than Steven Adams is. Like, he is an enormous, enormous dude. And the other thing about him, he plays fucking mean in the best way. Like, I've talked to that kid. I've talked to him for a while. Like, I've talked to him for like an hour, hour and a half. And he is the nicest. Like, he is laid back. He is a really awesome kid. Also, when he gets on the court, he is mean. He is physical. He is just like, he is the best screener in college basketball, truly. And I mean that, like, he is awesome as a screener. He has figured out like how to flip screens. He makes contact on every single damn screen. He absolutely wants like to have that physicality. Like, he played hockey growing up for a little while. He kind of brings that a little bit to basketball. I think like baseball was more his thing. Like, he was a pitcher when he was younger too, but like, he played hockey for a minute there too. And like, he liked hitting people when he played hockey. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a thing. Like, he plays with that kind of physicality. And those are the kind of guys that I think have some success in the NBA, at least on some level.
One of the things that I think about with Edie is this idea that, you know, going back years, is that I've always, I'm not putting a ceiling on him. I haven't watched a lot of film other than just as I see Purdue here and there. I always love it when a second unit, you know, whether you go full bench or you go mixed lineups, depending on how you want to run things, has a theory of how they're going to like score. And so one of the older school ones, and you could use, there are a lot of different players you could go back to in time, is like a guy who can do post-ups and high pick and roll. And so the idea is like, and as a backup, there are so many different ways that teams use the center spot now. Like, there are some teams that go really small there, like the Oklahoma City Thunder do. There are some teams that go bigger there. And what I'm intrigued by with the concept of Edie, more I'll have to do the actuality at some point, is that he can be that big man focal point there. And maybe the limitations for him will make it so that he's a tough fit as a starter. And I've thought about this a lot in terms of the point guard spot too, because generally speaking, your backup wings are going to be bad. Like, that's just the way the league works. There aren't enough good ones to be starters. So then, you know, the backups are going to be weak. And So that means you're generally looking for your identity elsewhere. And so that's why I think it's the five and the one. And Edie might end up being that natural foil, being that player who you put him with a maybe even a low ceiling, but a capable high pick and roll point guard. And you just make those things work. Ideally, you get maybe a little bit of spacing. You get a little bit of athleticism and you just see where it goes. And that's, you know, that's not the player you'd probably take at five, but it could be a player you're happy with at 25.
Do you know where he'd be great? Boston.
I like it.
Boston would be fantastic because they have like a bunch of guys that can run ball screens for him. He can seal and do stuff. Everybody on their team around him can shoot, basically.
I have another team.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oklahoma City would really work for him, I think, as well. They wouldn't do it because a big thing for them is like having all of, they like to play five out, like everybody being able to dribble, pass, shoot. So I don't think they would do it just because like that seems to like this was why they had Darius Bazley and Isaiah Roby and guys like that playing the five for years upon years. And their theory behind drafting Alexei Pokushevsky and everything like that. Like they want all five positions to be able to dribble, pass, shoot, or at least like bring something to the table in that regard at the center position. And Zach can't do that. But in theory, you're right that would be a great idea for them, like to have that counter breaker to be able to do that.
It'll be fun to see what happens with him. The other guy, I mean, there are a lot of other ones we can discuss, but the other one that I remember being high on your list and that I've been interested in is Nikola Topic, who's playing right now. Yeah. He's at Red Star, right? So he
signed with Red Star originally, got loaned to Mega, and then once he balled out for Mega, decided to go back and play for Red Star. And Red Star recalled him is what happened. Sorry. I don't mean I'm sure there was like a negotiation, like, you know, Topic's agent is Mishko Raznatovich, and Mishko is like most powerful agent in that region. And I'm sure that there was like a real conversation on like what is best for everybody. And Topic kind of decided what he wanted, but you know, Red Star thought they could use him. And, you know, up until he got hurt, like they were playing him at least. And it was interesting.
There are the standard kind of questions. So Topic, bigger guy, bigger, you know, kind of can be a creator, is a capable passer from what I understand, but it's, can he create separation, or is he so good at the like screen manipulation stuff that it'll work?
Yeah. So he does a lot of ISO stuff and a lot of mismatch stuff in the Adriatic League, where teams in that league generally switched a lot onto him and just like tried to let him beat them. And he did. And like, he didn't need a screen to do it. Like, he was able to just like beat mismatches. I'm really interested to see how that translates to the NBA. I don't know if I have a great answer for it yet. It might really work where he just like takes a ball screen. If they switch, like, we'll go and he can just get to the rim. It might be that like NBA bigs are more athletic than Adriatic League level bigs, and he struggles to maintain that same separative ability. I don't know. Like, the answer is I truly just don't know what it's going to look like.
How is he as a shooter?
That's the swing skill, is the shooting. Mm-hmm. It's quite inconsistent right now. I think his footwork is what tends to let him down a little bit. Doesn't kind of get into the shot the same way every time. If he can fix that, I'm quite interested. And most guys can fix like footwork things with shooting. You know, it's when you like have like some funky like body mechanics release wise that the concerns come in. But the shooting is like the main, he has touch. It's just like, can he consistently knock them down?
And what's hard with Topic is, like, you brought up the jump shot being a swing skill. This is the second time we get to invoke Dante Exum in this podcast. It's that if you can't do the thing you're best at an NBA level, then it becomes a lot harder to be valuable. And like, you could think about how much it's taken for Exum to grow. And like, you could even, and I mean, as good as Vasily Micic is, or you could bring up various different players, if you're like a
the guy Topic reminds me a lot of is Miloš Teodosic, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Like there's a lot of
prime. I wish we'd gotten prime Tadosic in the NBA, but that's neither here nor there.
Not quite as wild as Milos was. And like, not as like Milos was like freaky creative and still is. If you watch him, like he is insanely creative still, but the movement patterns, like kind of similar in that regard. And I think he is like a more skilled scorer. And like, I think he's longer than Teodosic is. Like, I think that he can get paint touches a little bit easier than Milos could. But yeah, like the key, like I would have loved to have seen Milos when he was young, like playing in the NBA. We didn't get Milos in the NBA until he was what, 2017. He was 30 by the time he got to the NBA.
Yeah. And with a player like Teodosic, that the athleticism that had declined, that actually made a bigger difference. I mean, it's something that people lose sight of sometimes. They're like, oh, well, if the guy's not that athletic in the first place, it doesn't matter. Oh, no, it matters more a lot of the time, because then they don't have that. Because then they can't like stay. They can't get the separation. They can't stay in front of their man defensively and all that. And that, those were both big problems for Milos when he was in the NBA. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Topic can do. And like, it's again, like you, for people who are less familiar, I mean, even I'm less familiar with a lot of these guys. There is so much of this, not only eye of the beholder, but like, what am I beholding type of an idea that's really fascinating about this class, where it's like, there are elements of, even if I'm evaluating this prospect correctly, I also need to be evaluating the league correctly or evaluating my team correctly. And that's what's really different. Like, you could think about a player like Paolo, or you could think about even Jabari Smith, who's having a much better year this year. Like, where you kind of, if you thought you evaluated them correctly as a player, things would make sense. That's right. Not what this is. It appears with like basically any of these guys, even with like Research Day, we were talking about how he kind of may fit in a different box, but like, it's remarkable how consistent that is with these guys. Like, every single one of them is some weird version of a box breaker.
It really is. Like, we haven't even talked about the guy that like I think is the favorite to go number one right now. Like, if you made me pick one guy that I think, like, if I had to place a bet on a player going number one right now, I would probably say Alex Saar. So like, Alex Saar, the player he reminds me most of is if you gave Nick Claxton like the potential to shoot.
Okay.
Really interesting player in theory, right? Like, really, really interesting player. Saar's jumper has great touch. Like, he gets great trajectory on the ball, very high arcing jumper. Really, you can buy it one day that he will shoot. Also, he has a lot of side spin on the ball, because I think he has a lot of offhand stuff there. And the results are not consistent at all. So it's like, how much do you want to buy into him potentially being able to shoot at some point? Because if he's a shooter that can be the defensive game breaker that he has potential to be due to his movement skill, I think you do take him at number one in this class. If he is a guy that you don't trust to shoot, I think some of the other things that pop up in his game, like, he's not a phenomenal rebounder. He is, from a rolling perspective, there are moments where it looks good, but largely he's going to like not make contact on screens. He's going to like try and ghost and pop. He's going to try and like pop and like dribble drive, maybe. He has he has some real ball handling ability, like at 7'1", but like people want to try and use like the like Chet Holmgren, Victor Wembanyama, like those kind of guys for Alex. And I think those are a great like aiming point for Alex. I like, if I was Alex's trainer, I'd be like, yeah, like watch these guys. Like, you should watch these guys. Also, I would have him watch guys that like make contact on screens and like really, you know, try and create that like separation a lot of the time. But defensively, he's like unbelievable. Like, he flies around the court. His ground coverage is truly elite. He is an elite mover. And he is 7'1" with a 7'5" wingspan. Like, there are a lot of tools there. It just really depends on how you evaluate the offensive game. And there are a lot of positives that you can look at into the future potentially with him as an offensive player, and a lot of question marks that you can raise and wonder if it's ever going to get there.
I also, like, from your description, one of the things that intrigues me, and this is, you know, going back to Claxton and everything else, is the idea that the versatile, skinny, tall dude is actually potentially valuable, where the, like, I think that there's a little bit too much focus on, can you defend Jokic? Can you defend Embiid right now? And if you can fulfill different responsibilities, if you're scheme versatile defensively, then teams can set it and forget it. But the other part,
the teams that matter for if you can defend Jokic or Embiid are the teams that they have to play in the playoffs.
Right.
Like,
but even then, like, I think the general truth that we've seen is that unless you have an AD or somebody like that, it's going to be a team effort, but typically it's not actually going to be your five. It's going to be your four. Or if you have a super duper strong three, and then you do the old Celtics, like, Robert Williams thing.
This is the team where, like, this is a concern right now, is Oklahoma City, right? Like, Oklahoma City is going to get wrecked by Jokic as presently constructed in a playoff series, because their four man is Jalen Williams. I love Jalen. He's too small to deal with Nikola. Nikola will put him into the basket at the end of the day. Jalen is very strong, but he'll shoot over the top of him and put him in the basket. That's just the reality. They need to go find a body, in my opinion. Like, whoever you want to...
A Zach Edey?
Well, I was going to say, like, they need to find it this year, because I think they could win the title this year.
They could be good.
Yeah, but, like, it's, you know, be it Wendell Carter, Daniel Gafford, whoever, what ex-center on the potential theoretical trade market du jour, right? Find that guy. The guy that I think they should try and get is probably Wendell Carter, because Wendell Carter, if you go back and you watch his tape, weirdly, has had some success against Jokic, and you could theoretically still play five out with him and Chet on the court together. But the other piece of it is, for Oklahoma City, do you care? Do you just let Jokic go fucking nuts and say, we're gonna out offense you guys because our offense is better than your offense is? And that's, I think, an interesting conversation for them, particularly because they have a top three player in the league right now, in my opinion, in Shea. They are one of the few teams that has a center the teams actually have to close out on. Like,
right,
you can't get a late closeout on Chet. Like, even Brook Lopez, teams mostly are pretty good, like, getting a late closeout on Brook Lopez. They do stay attached to him a little bit more than other centers, but, like, Miles Turner, teams are good getting a late closeout on Miles Turner. With Chet, you have to stay attached. That opens up driving lanes everywhere for them, every single place for them, especially if they're able to play lineups with somebody, you know, replacing Josh Giddey, who I am interested in long term. But, like, in a playoff series, what teams will do is kind of similar to what teams throughout the season have done. The Celtics, the Rockets stand out particularly both. They put their center on Josh Giddey and said, you know, go nuts, everybody else. We're just going to have our center stay in the paint and try and cut off these drives, right? If they go get a real shooter and a real big, they can win the title, I think, is where I'm at.
OKC is fascinating. And I agree with you. Like, I mean, I did a pod with Matt Moore recently where we talked about how they're, like, their title window is, it'll be probably more open a year from now, but it's open now. I mean, Shea, I still want to see what he'll do as a playoff player is still a big question. Like, you don't generally see teams this playoff inexperienced go all the way in 1 year, but they have the talent. Like, that's completely fair. And the West is a very weird place right now. So, like, how they could do there. I mean, Denver's still very good. They got that nice win over Boston on, I believe that was Friday.
And to be clear, Denver would be my title favorite right now. I'm not saying that the Thunder are, like, the favorites to win the title. Their window is open, though.
I think that's fair. And the other part of it from OKC's perspective, which is just such a ridiculous luxury, is they have so many resources, both spending power and draft picks. And you could even say some young players of interest that aren't essential to what they're doing, though I don't know how motivated another team would be to get a Trey Mann or something like that. Because the guys that you need to keep. But they could get Wendell Carter. They could get, maybe you want a shooter with a little bit more heft than Isaiah Joe, though I love Isaiah Joe, and not just be pot committed for the next 5 years. Like, that, they have the ability to do that. And first of all, I will say this very openly, if Wendell Carter is available for a reasonable price, there should be about 20 teams trying to get him. Like, that's the, even though he doesn't probably match the threshold we've talked about a lot over the years of like the centers that like are so good they have to close, he is one of the better centers who might not fit that description and has the talent to maybe eventually get there or to just be good enough. Like, this is the old like Bam Adebayo thing, which is like that choice never mattered for him because why would you ever sub him out? And like, I'm not saying he'll be as good as Bam.
But for Wendell, it doesn't matter because he's cheap enough to where you can have him close.
And he's cheap. He's cheap enough. And like, you can do a bunch of different things with him defensively. And so like for OKC, like you could get him and not break anything. And like, and but for other teams too, like, I mean, I think he's a better version of what some teams are doing. And I know this year has been hard. I still believe in him pretty aggressively. And
by the way, like for the Magic, I kind of have liked what they've done with Goga more than I've liked Wendell for them. Like, I think that Goga's level for those first probably 20 games, particularly, I think it's probably been a little bit worse recently, but like Goga's level for those first 20 games, I thought was probably better than anything I've seen from Wendell, in terms of the way that they've operated as a team with that guy in the middle. Goga's rim protection, I think, is such a substantial deterrent for everybody that he's like kind of a necessity almost. Like, you need like a great rim protector, I think, next to Paolo, not like a Wendell Carter level rim protector who is good, but is like more of a multifaceted, versatile defender who you can do a few different things with and who can guard one-on-one on the block and who can move his feet like in different ways in ball screens and things like that. What they do with the big position moving forward is like an incredibly interesting question to me for them.
It is. And it's not the only one, because I'm wondering when they're going to, you know, they have the resources to get a more dynamic offensive guard. And I love Suggs. And if he can stay on the floor, like, I think Suggs can be a part of a good team. And, you know, like, you can lean more on Paolo and Franz than most teams, if not any team, can on their 3 and 4 offensively, other than like, I guess, a LeBron team or something like that. But I still think they need a best offensive player. And the good news for the Magic is they can absolutely do that. Like, they have the resources available with spending power and everything else. It's, and then there's a whole other podcast that we could do on this point, because it's like, it's the Magic, potentially the Jazz, potentially a few other, the Spurs, where it's like, that's their biggest need. But the big problem is, it doesn't seem like there are new guys coming into the league who fit that. And then the players who fit that description of being like the best offensive player on a top 20 offense aren't going anywhere for right now. That will change, but for right now, those guys aren't going anywhere.
You brought up the Jazz. Are we like certain beyond belief that Lauri Markkanen is not that guy?
I am not certain. I think he could be. I mean, there have been times where, well, or where he is the guy who is so good at what he does that you can have a 20 to 30 point guard and still be damn good. Like, that, I think is completely fair. And I mean, the Jazz during this run have been extremely impressive. It's gone under the radar because they've gone from being towards the bottom of the league to towards the middle. And those kind of, I think it was something like 15-5 or 14-5, something like that. And with some really big wins. But it's a lot to ask historically. Like, the idea, and I'm sure this is how Danny Ainge is going to think about it, is like, you might as well try to get that player anyway. And they again have massive resources to do it if they want to. But they may, and this is, and it sounds like from what I've heard, you may have better sourcing on this, that like the Jazz would be totally fine losing their pick this year, because it's a weaker draft, and because then that kind of clarifies things moving forward because they have this top 10 pick that they owe. But it's really fascinating because they may be at the point like where they're going to need their volume in terms of resources, because they're a little bit too good with their own stuff to get the premium player, whatever year that player happens to come in the draft. Like, getting from the 10th pick to the 2nd pick is generally extremely hard, especially if it's a draft that has a player that you think is worthy of it.
Yeah, that's kind of the issue, is like, you can't really even do that if there's a guy that's like worth it, unless you're moving another star. Like,
exactly.
I think last year Like, I don't know if they would have moved Brandon Miller for Scoot Henderson at two. I'd be interested to find out, but like,
it the Ingram for number two or number three discussion is one of those that like ultimate recent fly on the wall. Like, how much did the Pels discuss it? What were the Hornets, not the Hornets, well, the Hornets or the Blazers willing to accept? Yeah. I have no idea.
Yeah, I know, right? It's a fun one. It's a really,
and
really
like,
fun
and
one.
And like, everyone would lie to you. Like, everyone who was in that room is going to be because of the people involved and everything like that. The last brief thing I want to do with you is, I don't want to go in depth on these guys, but you and I both were high on the 2023 draft class.
Yeah,
it's been it's been a weird start, but are there any, the way I think the, just the short version of this conversation is, are there any players who your evaluation is significantly different on right now than it was in June?
Look, I tend to be pretty patient on this stuff. Like, even like Scoot's probably the one we're talking about most, just because Scoot is the player that like people are melting down about in this regard, right? I am not in any way worried about Scoot, because if you look at the track record of teenage guards that were one and dones that come into the league, do you know how many good ones there have been, Danny, in the last decade? Do you know how many like good, legitimately like solid rookie point guards there have been that were teenagers and one and
done? Like none.
There's one. It's one player. Now you look like you kind of want to guess, so I'm going to let you guess.
No, it's fine. You can.
It's Trae Young. Trae was really good.
Sure. Okay.
Trae was great as a rookie. But these guys that are like 6'4" or shorter, that come in and have to literally run the show as a fucking teenager, it's hard. It's very hard. Like, De'Aaron Fox was one of the worst players in the NBA as a rookie. He is now currently an all-NBA caliber player. He made the all-NBA team last year, probably should make it again this year. Darius Garland, I think, was probably one of the worst players in the NBA as a rookie. He made the all-star team in 2022 and has consistently been very, very good since then. He's been all-star quality, right? Russell Westbrook, very much super inefficient, could get where he wants to, struggled in the same way that Scoot did as a rookie. Kobe White, it took Kobe White 5 years to come around because Kobe was quite young when he came into the NBA.
It took Conley a while.
It took Mike Conley a very long time as a teenager, rookie, one and done. Kobe White, by the way, over his last 30 games, 22 points, 5 rebounds, 5 assists, shooting 48, 43, 83. Like,
oof. Yeah, he's doing it. And the Bulls have been winning, and they've been playing good offense generally during that stretch.
Exactly right. Like, these teenager guards that come in, there is no more difficult thing that we ask in the NBA than a teenager who is a point guard to come in and run a show. Scoot, I think, has not looked good, undeniably. But these guys never look good. It's kind of my point.
It's like, a great point.
Ja Morant and Tyrese Halliburton, two guys that came in and looked good. They had 2 years in college to figure it out. Or, you know, yeah, Ja Morant had two. Tyrese kind of had like 1.5, but had like a full offseason of college to figure it out. It takes these guys a long time. Now, where I will say I was like kind of wrong on Scoot was I thought that his finishing would be better than what it is. And what I think that I and other scouts are learning through the G League Ignite is that the G League is not a very good league to evaluate from, because there's no real size on the interior. Like, anybody who's in the United States outside of J Huff, seemingly, if you have size and you can protect the rim, you are probably not in the G League. You're probably on an NBA roster. You look around, there's just not a lot of them there. There's not a lot of size that you learn how to finish around. Number two, because there isn't a lot of continuity among rosters where guys are coming up and coming down, guys are, you know, on assignment, and then the guys that are on assignment probably have the biggest roles because their, you know, parent club want to see them rock in some way, shape, or form. So there's no role continuity. There's no roster continuity a lot of the time. It creates very strange situations roster-wise. And then number three, the defensive continuity is just not very strong in the league because of any of that either. And that I don't say this to disparage anybody in the G League, but also number four, they're not really playing for anything from a team perspective. Like, all due respect, like, nobody really cares who wins the G League championship. Like, I think that it was Philadelphia and Houston's G League teams in the title last year. I don't know that, like, everybody on in those front offices would know that, like, their team was in the G League title last year. Maybe I'm underestimating that, but, like, it's just not a thing. But you're not playing for anything competitive, is my point. You're playing for a call up, which is different. It's a different kind of competitiveness. It's a different kind of, like, frankly, like, in some respect, selfishness, because you're playing for yourself as opposed to a team. So the G League is not a great league to evaluate from, is kind of my point here. And I think where I probably missed on Scoot early on is that I thought the finishing would be a little bit better. I thought he had great craft. I thought he showcased some real, like, touch around the basket, some inside hand stuff that was creative. I thought that his below the rim footwork to create an angle on rim protectors was very crafty and interesting. But it's just clear that, like, it's taking him a minute to adjust to NBA length in a real substantial way. So he doesn't really have any way, because he's still learning how to shoot. And oh, by the way, like, the shot, I think, has been, in the important respects, better than what I thought. He's shooting like 22 or 25% or some shit on catch and shoot threes right now. He's shooting 39% from three on pull up threes, and he's taking a couple of them per game.
It's interesting.
And, like, realistically, that's the shot that matters for him. And on top of it, you wouldn't really expect him to be a great shooter off the catch right now, because he's never done it before. Like, he's had the ball in his hands his whole career. So I still say, like, I'm not that worried.
That's Keontae George too. Like, Keontae George, bad catch and shoot guy, because he's never had to do it before, which is because the footwork's totally different. A lot of other things are. So I'm not comparing. I'm not saying the arc is going to be the same, but I think this is a worthwhile data point. Portland drafted Damian Lillard in 2012. And Lillard was those early years, he was around 50%, 53, 51 finishing his first 2 years. And it was a very different NBA at that point, to be abundantly clear. And Lillard's an unbelievable athlete, but Scoot is a very good athlete too. He eventually, you know, he generally lived in the 60s, other than the year where he had that ab thing and a few other things. And, like, it, for a player who has good physical tools, I'm concerned, but I'm not freaked out, because that type of thing can get better. And, like, with Scoot, I've been more impressed at times with his defense. And, like, he's not making as many of the, like, non-obvious passes as he did in the G League film, but it's a different world. Like, I'm not super freaked out. And, like you said, the passage of time.
He lives in the paint. Like, he lives in the paint. Like, he has no issue getting to his spots.
Yeah. He lives in the paint on what is one of the worst, like, statistically, one of the worst finishing teams around the basket in the history of the league. So there are some limitations there. And Scoot is, of course, a contributor to that, but he's also not the only one. The group that I'll just briefly discuss is actually, they're all players that I didn't watch film on, which I think there's something to that, where it's like, where I just go, oh, he can play. And so that's not saying they're going to be stars. That's not saying anything else. Yeah. And so, like, that group to me includes, but is not limited to, Derek Lively, Bilal Coulibaly, who I just watched. I watched some film on him recently. I'm still trying to figure out Cason Wallace, because some of his stuff is just wild, but I think he's a good player. Hawkins shooting, I think, is completely real. Hawkins has had a really nice year. Pajemski, I don't know what kind of player he is, but he is a player. And then, like, there are a lot of other guys that's like, they're definitely, like, talented. They're like, they might be in that realm. And so, like, I'm watching more Whitmore and a few other guys, but, like, that's pretty good. Like, you think about that these players don't always get opportunities, and some of them are in favorable spots, like Derek Lively, but Lively's been great. Like, it's not just you get to play with Luka and Kyrie and things go well. Like, he has maximized a lot of the things, and he has shored up some of the things that I, going back to the Hoop Summit, that I was like, we'll see on that. And he's been great.
No, I mean, Lively keeps his game simple is a big thing. Like, he's just valuable at rim running, running the court hard in transition, protecting the basket. Like, he's really good. And honestly, like, they haven't even gotten, like, wildly creative with him in ball screen coverages yet, which is where I think he can really bring value. Like, he can move his feet, like, hard hedging, blitzing in the NBA, like, on occasion. You can play him, like, more at the level and recover. Like, a lot of the time, I feel like they just play drop, because, like, it's kind of the easiest thing for them to do. But I think he can do more as he ages and grows and matures. I think Lively is going to be a really, really good defender. you bring up Hawkins' shooting. I think Hawkins' shooting is a really good call. Bilal Coulibaly, like the fact that he can hang on an NBA court is so enormous for Washington. Like him being able to get these reps, get comfortable, that's where growth kind of happens, I think, is when you can get on the court and you can adjust to the speed of the game and you can understand what it looks like. Coulibaly is like not doing anything on the ball. He's not doing like his role is so minimal in what they ask him to do compared to other NBA players, but just getting to see it and getting to experience it. And the fact that he's not taking anything off the court for them, in my opinion, at least when he's out there, is such a benefit to what he's going to be able to bring long term to the Wizards. Like he is going to be awesome. If I had to redraft, he would go, I think, a little bit higher than certainly where I had him. I had him like, you know, somewhere in the lottery, like 11 or 12 or so. I would have him higher, even though he hasn't necessarily showcased it. I think that like the shooting, the defense is going to really translate for him. And then hopefully that's where growth can happen with some of the latent flashes that you see of him on the ball.
It's going to be fun. And like he had, so I watched this morning, I watched the Spurs Wiz game from, I think it was from Saturday.
I have a good question for you here momentarily, whenever you get done with this, but continue.
So basically I had this moment, and part of it is like San Antonio's second unit isn't great. And like anytime Victor Wembanyama's not on the floor, they're not always great. But like there were some times that Coulibaly and his former Mets 92 teammate were on the floor together. And it was just like, there was this moment when Coulibaly and Avdija like were driving what became a Wizards 10 point lead that then they blew. And I was just like, this isn't a question necessarily of like the Wizards backups are better relative to other teams' backups than their starters are relative to other teams' starters. Like that's the old, like those Kings teams when Fox's like on off black box ratings were so bad. That was a big part of the story. I'm not sure whether the like an Avdija Coulibaly led group is actually worse than the Wizards starters. Like I'm saying as a basketball player, like if you just swapped, I think you could make a better version of them. And that's also because I feel like now I've become one of the more known Kyle Kuzma haters, but it's also the idea that like they don't necessarily need somebody who does what he does and all that. But it's like the other part is like
Coulibaly, I disagree with that in their case, but I understand your point.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's interesting, but I want to get to your question.
My question for you is, if you had to take Bilal or Amen Thompson right now, which one would you take long term? If you had to redraft the two of them, not saying which one has been better this year, if you had to take them both for the long term, which one would you take? Because they're both like they're interesting because they're both tools bets at the end of the day, right?
Unless so I think that Bilal has Coulibaly has a higher expected value. Because you know, his jump shot is slow, but I do think that it's not bad. And like
the floor is so much higher. It's
so much higher. I would still take a men because most teams you're actually more focused on not necessarily the ceiling, but the top 20% outcomes. And if it works for a men, it is going to work at a level that is extremely exciting. And I am not yet willing to foreclose on that, even as he's shooting what, like 15% from three and all these other stuff. Because there are some real concerns. But also, like you see with Asar too, like there are elements of their game that actually work really well. Like the instincts defensively and like some of the other stuff is there. And there are limitations, but it's like, I'm not it's not even betting on my board because I didn't watch Coulibaly, but like, I think that the athleticism, like, especially because Amen Thompson, like they have credible size. Like they're like, I think of when I watch Coulibaly in that game, I'm like, he might be more of a two. And I don't mean that as a bad thing. Just like he would need to get so big to be a three, like to be a straight three. He has the length for it. But like, you know, like you brought up Kawhi earlier with Reed Shepard.
Mikhail is like the closest physical comparable to him. And Mikhail is not big and can play.
But Mikhail, I think he's a little quicker on his feet. Maybe I'd be interested to see some comparisons there and watch. And, you know, I'm going to watch a lot more Coulibaly over time. And Mikhail's not always the best in those matchups either. Like he can do a lot of things well. That's not necessarily. But like Amen, it's kind of like if he puts it together on offense or on defense, it's just a nasty, nasty player. Like the type of guy that breaks molds in a good and a bad way. So I would go Amen, but I wouldn't be surprised in the slightest if a year from now I went the other way.
Would you take Cam Whitmore or Amen Thompson?
I'd take him in. With Whitmore, like, he's definitely, like, he's benefiting from not being a Villanova anymore. Like, there are some real yes. perks there. But there still is the idea of, like, well, what is he to a really successful team? And I think he's a good player. I think there's a at minimum a rotation player in there. Like, I put Bilal Coulibaly over Cam Whitmore for me right now, based on what I know. I do want to do, like, probably in the next 3 weeks, I'm going to do a big Whitmore film dive. I just, you know, just depending on
it's
which
a,
15,
it's a wild ride, Danny.
Oh, of
it's
course.
It's a wild ride.
His it was a wild ride of the Villanova film. I mean, it's going to be, it'll be fun. But I like when it, I watch the Rockets and Pieces.
Wait until you see his off-ball defense. It is.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. He's been much better than what I thought on the ball. Like, if mm-hmm. you give him an assignment and say, like, we need you to stay in front of this guy, he can do it. Like, he has great strength. He's strong through his chest. He's very quick laterally. Like, he can do all of that. It's the awareness and, like, figuring out, like, where he needs to be off the ball, the instincts to figure it out.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. And this class is going to take some time to shake out in terms of a lot of different factors involved. And, like, there are a bunch of other guys like Keyonte George and various that we can talk about. And all the guys who aren't playing right now, like Jairus Walker and Taylor Hendricks, who's getting low-level minutes on the Jazz at times. And
Jairus Walker, they played him in the game where, like, it was between this, like, the Siakam trade had happened.
Where the trade had happened, but they hadn't gotten the players yet.
Right, so they played Jairus that game. Jairus hit a disgusting, like, left pound dribble to, like, behind the back, pull up, like, wrong footed as he got into the shot, realign in midair, pull up three. And I was like, oh, this is, I didn't know you could do that.
Like, it'll be fun. This comes up, and I'm sure there's an element, a trading for Siakam is different than playing Obi Toppin. But to go, oh, well, the Indiana Pacers, like, they basically just added a guy over him. And it's like, if Jairus Walker is good enough, they'll figure it out in time. And it's going to take him some time. That's not a surprise, I think, for the two of us who both, I believe, liked him, that it's going to be there. However, I knew when I opened this door, I was going to have to close it prematurely because you and I both have other things that we're going to do. So I will thank you so much for taking the time. And it's been a pleasure.
Of course, Danny. Anytime.
Thanks again to Sam Vecenie for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic, and you can also listen to the Game Theory podcast that he does very frequently. I was a guest doing a trade deadline preview, I think it was about a week ago, week and a half ago. Really did enjoy that, so you can check out his great work, and you can follow him on social if you feel so inclined. If you want to support this show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode in the podcast player of your choosing. If Real GM Radio is not in the podcast player of your choosing, please let me know and I'll pass it along up the chain. You can also help other people find the show by leaving a rating review in the aforementioned podcast player or word of mouth or social media. Really do appreciate all that. But the biggest thing you can do for Real GM Radio or any other podcast that has them is check out our sponsors for this episode. That is FanDuel. Go to FanDuel.com/Boston. New customers get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed when you place a $5 bet. Talked about that a lot earlier in the show. You can also check out my other work, Dunked On Prime, going strong, and we are getting closer to the mock trade deadline, which is always a ton of fun. Still wrapping my head around the responsibilities and opportunities there. You can also check out my written work at The Athletic, along with Sam's, and Nate and I are doing the NBA strategy stream for League Pass, which is really fun. We'll actually be doing a game on Monday, depending on when you listen to this. We'll be doing Celtics-Mavericks, should be really fun. 8:30 Eastern, 5:30 Pacific, and two really good teams. It's NBA rivalry week, even though those teams aren't historical rivals, still really happy to do it. And if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DanielLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I'm not the greatest at replying, especially given my fatherhood obligations, but I do read it. That is something I do every day before I go to bed, or often in the morning when I wake up, depending on when I'm checking my email. So I really do appreciate that. It does make the show better. So if you have something that you want to share, share. And that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.